Welcome to the Connected Commute podcast from Bolden Networks. Bolden Networks is unlocking the power of an interconnected future by bringing you insights in transport from around the globe. I'm Ian Montgomery of Label Sessions, and today Chris Bichette of Bolden and myself are talking to Daisy Chapman Chamberlain. Known as the Queen of the Railways, Daisy is the innovation manager for the new project at East West Rail. She's dedicated her career to connecting people through travel and helping communities flourish sustainably in the process.
Hello, everyone. Today we have Daisy Chapman Chamberlain with us, the Queen of the Rails. Daisy, I traditionally don't try and speak for you. I would like you to introduce yourself and tell us how you've come about your regal title.
Well, I was going to say thank you very much for the kind introduction. But yes, I have dubbed myself the Queen of the Railways. But unfortunately, I don't get paid to be the Queen of the Railways. I get paid to be the Innovation Manager at East West Rail, which, as many of your listeners will know, is a railway project between Oxford and Cambridge. So very exciting stuff. And I'm in the really privileged position of being able to do all of the fun, technological, new services, new ideas, whiz-bang stuff for that railway.
I want to dig into the East West Rail a little bit more, because that used to exist in another form, didn't it?
Yes. So there used to be the, I believe it was referred to locally as the Brain Line. So it's been, there are sections of that track that have been closed and sections of that track that never existed and sections of that track that are being brought back as part of this project. So it's a really interesting piece of work.
And a very important one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's connecting local communities, which is one of the most important factors. So the area itself of Oxford, Milton Keynes, Bedford and Cambridge has an annual economic contribution of £111 billion a year. Which obviously is an absolutely enormous economic contribution to the UK economy, not to mention, you know, the educational factor. So connecting people in those universities and colleges, obviously, two of the most famous universities in the world, the academic work that goes on there, the technological work that goes on there. You know, there's so much value in the area. So bringing back the railway line, and in some cases, obviously, we're building a new section of track too. So for clarity, we're upgrading a section from Oxford to Bicester, and then we're bringing back a section of railway between Bicester and Bletchley. And then we're building, we're refurbishing rather, existing railway between Bletchley and Bedford. And then the brand new railway is Bedford to Cambridge. So that's where we're building something that doesn't currently exist. It's a really exciting economic project.
So for a lot of our listeners will be familiar with it, but a lot won't. Particularly in America. So between Oxford and Cambridge, it's an arc that crosses north of London. I don't know how far north, but it's been referred to as the arc in the past. But today, if you wanted to travel from Oxford to Cambridge, you'd have to go all the way down to London and then back up.
Exactly. And it's one of these perennial issues in the UK is that travel across the country is always harder than traveling up and down the country. So we've obviously got fantastic north-south links, you know, along the west and east coast. And then within cities, of course, as most cities take a kind of radial approach, so branching out of the city from suburbs and then in and out. But east-west has always been a challenge. So obviously in the north, there's the Pennine route. So you can go across the Pennines. But certainly in the south, this is a really, really important connectivity opportunity.
And this will inevitably intersect some of those north-south lines, so it'll make a lot of other journeys easier, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just easier for one particular group of people either. I think it's important to keep in mind that, yes, this will hugely benefit the local communities, and that is who we're doing this for. But as you say, making it easier to commute, so if you're looking at employment opportunities, making it easier to engage in business travel, and making it easier to engage in leisure travel as well. You know, we're talking about, particularly for Oxford and Cambridge, two of the most historic, beautiful cities that exist anywhere in the world, that are in their own right, you know, tourist hotspots just as much as academic and economic hotspots. So there's a huge amount of opportunity there for all these different groups to be connected up, as you say, in different ways.
So even though this line existed in some form prior, you're basically doing a greenfield new line.
Yes. So only the last section. So only Bedford to Cambridge is the brand new, taking a different approach. And obviously, there's been a huge amount of work and research that's gone into that to make sure that the right links are being made and that the right route is being chosen. So making sure that we've got as much connectivity as we can, whilst keeping in mind that we're spending taxpayers' money, and we need to make sure that we're making, you know, sound fiscal decisions in terms of where that route can actually access and who we need to make sure that we're connecting up.
That must be exciting, though, starting from scratch. So many rail projects are constrained by the stations or the locations or everything that pre-existed, and you can't, without digging out a new entire station, you have to work with what you've got. You have carte blanche, basically. That must be exciting.
Definitely, in some ways. And I think within that context, though, it's important to keep in mind we do still need to make sure that we connect properly with the national network. So we can't just do whatever it is that we want to do. We need to make sure that whoever we hand over to, whether that's Network Rail or Great British Railways as the infrastructure owner and operator, or whoever we hand over to for the train operator, has a system that works comprehensively and interacts with, obviously, the rest of the national networks. I mean, imagine for a second if we just decided, oh, we're going to have a new track gauge. Sorry, we've decided we're going with a completely different gauge. Hope that's okay for the rest of the country. And of course, that kind of thing simply doesn't make sense. But what it does mean for that new section, and indeed for the entire line, is we can focus on future-proofing. So making sure that, obviously, we're looking to open the railway in the early 2030s. When we do open it, we need to make sure that it's fit for purpose. So future-proofing for the customers that we're going to have, whatever balance of customers we have and the different types of groups that will be using the railway. So making sure it's accessible and inclusive and comfortable and enjoyable and affordable and everything else. But then also making sure we're future-proofing in terms of infrastructure. So climate resilience is a really obvious one. And that's the kind of area where actually, yes, we can explore new technology, we can explore new methods, we can explore new construction methods to make sure that we've got a railway that is going to be fit for purpose in a customer sense and also in that infrastructure sense.
So there's a lot of, I'll call it nuts and bolts, a lot of regular train stuff that needs to be done, but a lot of innovation that can happen in there.
Oh, I've always got exciting things to talk about. But yeah, the potential for innovation is really wide. But I think it's important to keep in mind as well that when we talk about innovation, we're not always talking about reinventing the wheel. We're not always talking about something that's never been seen before. A lot of the time, innovation, I would say probably 90% of innovation that happens, if not more, is that incremental innovation that happens behind the scenes. You know, it's small, gradual changes to processes or to services or to products that just make them slightly better or slightly reduce production of carbon or slightly more affordable or whatever it happens to be. And that's really important. That is the root of innovation work. And then the new and exciting stuff that pops up and, you know, the new amazing technologies that people obviously invent every day across the UK and around the world, that's the really exciting stuff that goes into the newspapers. But obviously the majority of innovation does happen in a very incremental way rather than in a radical way. So it's also about thinking what we can learn from each other. And when I say from each other, I mean rail internationally. So in the UK, we try our best to pinch with pride. So steal each other's ideas, basically, in a very friendly way, which is brilliant because it means that we can use the best innovations that have happened on other networks or other construction projects. And certainly we learn a lot from our colleagues at High Speed 2, for example, and we're starting to learn more from our colleagues at the Global Centre of Rail Excellence as they're starting to, you know, gear up for operation of that particular project. So it's about making sure we learn from each other. And then in an international context as well, there's so much that we can learn from other nations in terms of how they're operating rail. So I think, yeah, we've got to make sure that when we talk about innovation, it's not just, oh, this is something that's never been done. In some cases, it's something that has been done. We're just doing it in a new way.
You mentioned, I love everything you just said, but you mentioned new and exciting. And sometimes that incremental development, that incremental innovation, it's not new and exciting. It's boring and overlooked. Those little common sense things, and there's so many of them, and there's a rising tide, I think, of people talking about, let's put some common sense back into this. Can you think of any common sense innovations that you've reintroduced to the program?
Well, I completely agree with you. There's a lot of stuff that is innovative and that we consider to be innovative that, as you say, is just boring, or certainly not boring to us, but would appear to be very boring to a majority of the public, which I think is the key point here. So, for example, around something like earthworks being obviously an enormous source of work for us and potential disruption for our communities. So we're doing everything we can in terms of our design, in terms of our planning, in terms of the processes that we're engaging with around those earthworks programs to make sure that they are as efficient and minimally disruptive as possible, and to make sure that we cause as little disruption to communities and in terms of biodiversity as we can. But it doesn't sound particularly exciting on the face of it, but in terms of the work that we're doing incrementally, it's absolutely vital to minimize that impact.
What about things in passenger experience? We're big on innovation in stations, and our focus is largely on improving the passenger experience, but we do recognize that there's at least five key stakeholder groups that we have to consider in all of these. But largely, I think my passion lies in making the experience better for passengers. Does your job touch on that at all?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So we're looking at the entire life cycle of the project, and that obviously includes the end goal of the project, which is to get people moving. So we've got a fantastic future customer team that's doing a lot of work across this piece. So everything, obviously, accessibility and inclusion is really high on the agenda. Making sure that our rolling stock is fit for all of the different customers that it will serve is really high on the agenda. Making sure that our stations are welcoming, friendly environments that fit in the local community is high on the agenda. So all of these different factors really feed into each other. But obviously, the stage that we're at in the project at the moment, you know, with the construction piece that we're looking at, we're very much looking at the kind of the delivery of that. Looking at the construction phase in a lot of detail at the moment, obviously ahead of our statutory consultation, but alongside that, making sure that we're always focused on the end goal, which is a service for the community and a service for the customers. And stations are so important. You know, a station, one of my favorite phrases around stations is that a station is the window to the community. And that's one of my favorite phrases from the world of community rail. And it's absolutely true. They're such important hubs. They're so much more than just places people run through to get from, you know, A to B. So making sure that the stations are fit for purpose and welcoming environments that serve multiple functions rather than just a single function is really important.
We locked on to stations are the pearls in the necklace of the railway.
I love that. I love that. That's very good.
So Daisy, you mentioned you've mentioned accessibility a couple of times, and you are the vice chair of the Inclusive Mobility Forum.
I am indeed.
Tell us some more about that.
I'm the vice chair of Inclusive Mobility Forum, as you say, which sits within ITS UK, so Intelligent Transport Systems UK, which is a membership organisation that supports exactly what it says on the tin, the development of intelligent transport systems and the implementation of those systems within the UK and indeed beyond the UK. And one of the key pieces within any transport system is obviously the inclusivity side of things. So when we talk about inclusion, we very often mean of the passenger, of the customer, depending on which phrasing you want to use. So making sure that if you have a digital system, that they're able to access it. So digital exclusion is a huge part of the work that's happening at ITS UK at the moment around actually, if you have this push for digital ticketing, which obviously we do in the UK, is there potential for exclusion of particular groups of people in different communities if you can only access your ticket, or if the most suggested route to access your ticket is digital. But then similarly, accessibility of the actual network itself, so things like wayfinding information. There's amazing technology happening now for people who are partially sighted and blind around different audio systems, and amazing work that's happening for people who are deaf. So we've all seen the sign language screens that have been put up in different stations, including Euston, where you have someone signing out information about platforms and services, which is just fantastic. So there are all of these different innovations and different really fascinating digital projects happening. But it is really important we make sure that those suit everyone. And if they don't, make sure that the options that are available are just as convenient and just as affordable and offer all the same opportunities. And then again, for staff, so we've got to make sure that staff are actually comfortable using the systems and also comfortable referring people to those systems. So it's about the entire life cycle of a project and all the people that interact with that, from the back office to the frontline staff to the passengers who may end up using a piece of technology, making sure that actually it fits the needs of everybody who may use that piece of technology.
You mentioned it earlier, that fits the needs of everybody. It accommodates everybody. Do you ever run into any resistance from people who don't have any disabilities, don't need any accommodation? Well, yet. To disabled people, these are key needs. These are things that are keenly attuned to them. For other people, they just don't pay any attention. And they may be using some of these later. They may, everybody's aging. And yet a lot of that population just doesn't give any attention to any of that. And if there's anything that they perceive inconveniences them, they resist.
In some ways, you know, there's always going to be resistance to some particular types of projects. Will always come up against resistance. And I think a lot of the time, actually, 99% of the time, when it comes to making the railways more inclusive, there isn't really an issue with the integration of those services. Because as you say, people who maybe are not disabled, sometimes they're using these services themselves anyway because they're helpful. And sometimes they use them in the future, or they use them maybe if they're on a route that they don't know particularly well and they think, oh, I could use additional information. They do access those services or those products or that technology or whatever it might be. I think one of the biggest barriers that I've observed, and not specifically East West Rail, but over the course of working across the rail industry, and my last role was rail lead at Innovate UK KTN, is actually sometimes there's a question of the value being attributed to these projects, or certainly the finance being attributed to these projects. So that's the only real barrier I've ever come up against, of why are we spending this money for a minority of the population? And that's what I really strongly challenge, because it's not a minority of the population. When we think about inclusion, we tend to immediately jump to the idea of a wheelchair user requiring access to a service. But when you actually look at, when we talk about, you know, making sure stations are accessible and inclusive, we're talking about so much more than that. We're talking about people who have got auditory and visual needs. Yes. We're talking about people who have got other mobility needs. We're talking about, you know, people who are maybe the elderly and therefore require additional levels of support. And then we're also talking about people who have got families. You know, we're talking about people traveling with children and pushchairs. We're talking about people who are traveling with luggage. We're talking about people who are neurodivergent. We're talking about tourists who maybe don't speak English as a first language. And suddenly that group that you've said, oh, well, that's a minority, why are we spending the money, actually becomes the majority group.
And that's exactly where I was going with that. An analogy I can make is trying to get support in transit, just for transit within the community. But a car lover, and there's a lot of them, may instinctively resist any investment in transit because they love their car. And so to change, we have to consider changing the language of it. You just eloquently explained all of the different various forms of, I'll put disability in quote, people who need assistance. But that's not the message that comes through. Like you say, instinctively, people think wheelchairs. People who love their cars resist transit, even though in further investment in transit will make their driving better. And so, I think we need to change the language or adapt the language to speak to those populations. And you just nailed it.
I think as well, there's a piece in this of the division of transport modes. So we think of rail as rail, and rail is rail, and it's trains and it's stations. And when you leave that station, that's it. Our role in that journey is done. And good luck, basically, with your onward travel. And it's similar in some ways with bus, and it's similar with cars in some ways, and micro-mobility solutions, so hire scooters and hire cycles. We do look at transport as individual modes, and that is a huge issue in terms of interoperability and connectivity and multimodality. So we've got to start having systems that connect those options up. And I mean in every possible sense. So talking about digital journey planning and wayfinding, I'm talking about ticketing, making sure you don't have to have six different tickets to make a single journey or six different payment options to make a single journey, because maybe you need a train ticket and then maybe at the end of that you need to use the tube and then maybe at the end of that you need to take a bus and perhaps you want to hire a scooter or maybe get an Uber or whatever it happens to be. So we've got to make sure that we've actually got connectivity across those modes so that they work together harmoniously. And that's where things like, yes, maybe someone is a car user. Parking at stations is something that we're constantly looking at across the industry, and things like EV charging and disabled car parking ports at stations as well. So making sure that all of these services and all of these modes are able to work together is one of the ways that we can ensure that actually, regardless of someone's first choice of transport, that they're able to interact harmoniously with the other modes of transport rather than feeling like they're in competition.
The door-to-door experience we've heard before. Exactly. Well, that's one of those often overlooked components of transit.
Door-to-door connectivity is absolutely vital, and we can't just look at, you know, journeys as separate chunks. No one looks at a journey as, oh, well, I've got to do this small chunk of journey, which is take me to the train station, and my next chunk of journey. It's our journey. It's a single process that's got different elements to it. So if we plan for people to travel like that, then we make it easier for people to travel like that.
So in that journey, in that door-to-door journey, what are the features within that journey that the innovation expert is looking at to maximize the use of the rail line? When your line is complete, what are you doing to ensure that you get as many people out there and the best experience for them in their journey?
This kind of, it links back to the wider piece across transport. So the latest statistics from Great British Railways Transition Team came out this week, and it found that leisure was the largest group of travellers now in the UK for rail use. And that leisure accounted for, I think it was 75% of the increase, the overall increase in revenue in the 3 months, March to June. And we've got to think about rail in that new context. So if this is the future, if people are going to be predominantly using rail for leisure purposes, then a leisure journey is very different to a commuter or a business journey, and it has different needs. So firstly, we've got to keep that context in mind, is that the needs are different. In a door-to-door context, of course, it's about making sure we recognize that a journey starts before someone even leaves their front door. So a journey starts with the process of journey planning and how they engage with that. So making sure that we've got somewhere that they can get comprehensive, up-to-date information. So real-time information is really key in this. Making sure that they're getting the best ticketing option, and ideally comprehensive ticketing, you know, is the dream. If we can make sure that people only need one ticket for their journey rather than multiple tickets for different modes, then that's going to be incredibly helpful. Making sure that people have got safe and accessible routes to the station, you know, however they're making that journey, ensuring that it's lined up. And then actually their process through the station itself. So wayfinding is absolutely vital. So we can all think of a station, and I won't name any because I don't want to upset any of my colleagues in any particular operator, but we can all think of a station where we've walked through it and gone, why on earth has it been laid out this way? This is completely unintuitive. So we've got to think, well, some of these issues are going to have to be solved with construction methods. Some of them are going to have to be solved in a very kind of intensive physical built environment way. But there are a lot of ways that we can make wayfinding easier using either signage and lighting and things in the environment that are easier to retrofit, or through digital methods. So there's really amazing technology now, which is augmented reality wayfinding, where you can hold up your phone and it uses the video feed that goes through your phone's camera to provide you with up-to-date real-time directions to your platform. So it knows that you need platform 3 because you're traveling to London Euston or wherever it happens to be, and it can take you to that platform. So there are some really, really interesting interventions for every stage of the journey. And then obviously when the person gets to the other end, making sure they can reach their final destination rather than waving them off out of the station and that being the end of their trip for us. It's not the end of the trip for them. So I think it's about looking at all those different use cases, looking at all those different needs, and making sure that we're not just providing information in the digital space. We've got to keep in mind that information also has to be in the built environment and in the real world for people to be able to fairly access that.
You've touched on another trigger of mine, the wayfinding through stations. I make the case that stations have been around for 180 years, and yet we can't get from one end to another without searching and hunting. And there's a lot of poor wayfinding within stations, and we've all walked out the wrong door, which has cost us 10 minutes to go entirely around the station again, or just had a terrible experience, which leads to further congestion in the station. So we've touched on this in the past, so I'll stop there, but it's a trigger for me. So recently, I can't remember the survey. Ian, do you recall the survey? Who did the Wi-Fi?
I think it was the Department for Transport, but triggered by the Treasury. And this is maybe where we go political, but we'll try and keep it compliant. But it basically went along the lines of what matters to passengers. And it was arriving alive, arriving on time, having a train service, and then Wi-Fi was quite far down the list.
It wasn't too far down past, you know, arriving alive and not dismembered and so on. A number of answers that I don't think should even be in the survey, because we all expect them to be there. But when Wi-Fi turned up fifth or sixth, they said, well, maybe we shouldn't invest in Wi-Fi anymore because it's clearly not important to people. But not important in the context of arriving alive. So we believe that connectivity is a key part of that experience you're talking about. Connectivity, a table that comes back from the seat. So you can actually have a productive journey and choose the train instead of the car because you're not behind the wheel. What's your take on Wi-Fi or other technologies as part of that journey?
So connectivity in all its forms is absolutely crucial in rail. So it's for the actual connectivity in a really general sense for passengers being able to access media, for example, on board, but also being able to access real-time journey information, being able to access even ticketing. I mean, I know most ticketing options, you can download them ahead of time and have them saved. But if you haven't, you know, making sure that people have actually got access to travel information, access to tickets is really important. And then obviously for business and commuters, making sure that they can actually work on their journey, as you say, so it's not dead space. And then for the leisure commuter, making sure that they can be connected to entertainment or music or whatever it happens to be that they might want to do. But it's not just about the passenger. Obviously, connectivity for staff is really important. So making sure that they've got connectivity to react to incidents, making sure that they've got connectivity for safety reasons. So it's definitely a really, really vital piece. And we've got a kind of perennial issue in the UK with, you know, dead spots when you're in the countryside and the issues generally of connectivity on rail in the first place. But it is something that is only going to become increasingly important as we look to an even more digitized future. More and more things, you know, for better or for worse, are being made available exclusively in the virtual space. And we've got to make sure people can access that regardless of where they are in the world or what method of transport they might be on.
This podcast is brought to you by Bolden Networks, unlocking the power of an interconnected future. We're delivering the advanced shared network infrastructures needed for a smart, inclusive, and sustainable future. From interconnected transit to venues, enterprises to smart cities, we're creating new possibilities in the way people live, work, and play. Find out more, visit boldin.com.
Those dead spaces are a common topic. Does that factor into your planning, into the operators or the builders of the railway? Do you have a discussion about how are we going to fix these types of issues 5 years down the road? Or
so it's looking at it more, I think, as a general industry piece. So looking at this as the whole piece across the sector is making sure that we are future-proofing as much as we possibly can as a rail sector, that we are making sure that we're addressing the needs of passengers, but also that we're making sure that we're also spending responsibly. So it's this really fine balance between making sure that everything is as connected as it possibly can be and making sure that we're spending in a way that is appropriate and suitable. So it's a huge issue for all of us across the sector that we're certainly looking at in a lot of detail.
I want to come back a little bit to where we were talking about getting more people on the rails and getting more usage from the train lines. I read an article in the Telegraph the other day talking about how railways were working their methods more toward resembling airlines. And I think we've all suffered some airline experiences. Is making the rail more like airline operations the way to go?
No, I couldn't disagree more strongly if I tried. The way to go for rail is to make rail an experience again. So people at the moment, much like you say, no one looks forward to traveling on a budget airline because it is an unpleasant, uncomfortable experience. We do not want to go. Rail should not be going in the direction of making rail an unpleasant, uncomfortable experience. We should be making it fun again, frankly. So there's so many examples. I mean, a really amazing example in the UK, which admittedly isn't an everyday option, but the Pullman dining train from Great Western Railway is an incredible, incredible experience that people absolutely adore. You know, it's almost always fully booked. It's incredible food. It's, you know, a fantastic way to travel. And yes, not an everyday way to travel, but it's a part of the tapestry that makes up why rail is such a special industry. In an everyday kind of sense, just making sure that seats are comfortable, making sure that people have enough leg room, making sure, as you said before, that people have a table to pull out so they can work, making sure people have charging points at their seats. So just making sure that rail at a minimum is a comfortable experience and at its best is an exceptional experience. And again, looking at what's happening in Europe, you know, the sleeper train renaissance. We've got two sleeper trains, of course, in the UK. We've got the Knight Riviera and we've got the Caledonian. And they're both incredibly popular options. Looking at what's happening on the continent with, you know, OBB's new Nightjet service, which is already hugely booked up. And there's so much demand for sleeper services happening. That's the kind of thing that we need to be focusing in on more as an industry across the UK and indeed across Europe and beyond, is actually what do we do to add in these special experiences and what do we do to make sure that just everyday travel is comfortable and enjoyable?
Totally agree.
There's like an interesting thing around how, because you get to do something net new, you already talked about like future-proofing it. You talked about the shift post-pandemic to more leisure travel. But I think a lot of rail operators have to be quite reactive to those changes. Like they've got locked in decisions around rolling stock. They're working with heritage stations. They've committed to contracts. Do you get to do like more fun stuff around, actually, we have the opportunity to reinvent what the standard is or what the practice is, whether that's seating or station experience and things like that? Are there things that you're looking at going, we have this chance to do something really cool, or if only I could do this?
I think it's almost looking at it in layers. So you've got the really basic, and it kind of goes back, I think, to that DFT survey that you referenced before of, well, what's the number one priority to get there alive? And whilst I think it's maybe a little bit hyperbolic, ultimately, we need to look at things in that kind of layer. So the number one priority for people is to make sure they have a service that they can use and a service that gets them there and a service that gets them there on time and safely. Those are the number one priorities. The number one priority of rail is always safety of passengers and of staff members. And that always has to be number one. But then it's about what layers almost we can add in on top of that. So then we can start to look at things like the rolling stock environment. So we've got people on board and we're on time. What about the actual design of the stock itself? So how can we make sure, again, that it is fully physically accessible? How can we make sure there's enough space on board for luggage? If you're Great Western Railways, for example, things like storage of surfboards is a really interesting question, because of course there's nowhere to store a surfboard safely on board a train. That's very, very specific issue to them. Cycles is one that constantly comes up for everyone across the country. So storage of bicycles when you're traveling on trains and making sure that that kind of need is met. Traveling for families. So the Campaign for Family Friendly Trains in the UK does a huge amount of work, you know, outlining what could be done to rolling stock to make it more family friendly and easier for people who are traveling with children in particular to use. So then you add that layer in, and then the kind of final layer on top of it all is that exceptional experience piece. So in Japan, for example, they've got trains where you can put your feet in a foot spa as the train is traveling. There's a foot spa train in Japan. There are all, I mean, there's every type of train that you could imagine.
They have a cat train.
Yes, cat train, Hello Kitty train, Pokemon train, incredibly every option from the strange to the most luxurious services you can possibly imagine. So I think there's a lot in terms of experience that we can probably take away from some of the Japanese services, certainly. But it's about looking at things in terms of those different layers and making sure that once you've got the safety and reliability aspect, what can you build in around that to make sure that a journey is actually comfortable and fun wherever possible.
So a lot of these ideas that you get from other places, we talked about the boring incremental updates are very important, but those are easy. Are there any ideas that you've gotten from other places that would take some bravery to implement that you have in the back of your mind that you would like to see 5 years down the road?
I don't think we're going to be implementing a foot spa train on the East West Railway line anytime soon, put it that way. But for us, because we are a very locally connecting line, so we're connecting local communities, it's very much about that comfort level comes first. So making sure that we've got a service that is fit to connect those different areas and make sure that the people who are going to be traveling with us are going to have an enjoyable journey. So I think number one, most of what we're doing is that incremental improvement. In terms of the really exceptional stuff, we're always looking at new ways to do things. So everything from construction through to passenger experience. And I think it's because we are still quite early stage in terms of, you know, our planning and development, for us, it's going to be about making sure we actually talk to local people about those and about what they want to see. So we've done a huge amount, and there's ongoing community consultation work where we're really open and listening to what the communities and local people say they want to see from the line, from the trains, from the stations, etc. And honestly, I think that's the most important factor, rather than it being, we could theoretically implement A, B, or C. It should be led by the end users. So that's something that we're really focusing in on as we move forward.
I know you travel around a fair bit. You were in Amsterdam last year. To me, I've never been to Asia, but to me, Amsterdam is the model I hold for transit and its various forms and how they all come together. And I think it's my personal mecca for transit. Have you been anywhere where you said that is spectacular? That's an amazing thing I've got to bring home, or been to places where you've learned something new that you said we have to adopt this back home?
I mean, Amsterdam is an amazing example. Absolutely. I love using the U-Bahn and S-Bahn in Berlin. I think those are fantastic examples of just very well done, you know, underground and rail services that operate in, certainly from my usage, in a very efficient and regular manner. Now, obviously, German mainline trains have got their own challenges and challenges as, you know, we face across the UK. But I think for me, it's about the connectivity of those different services in a place like Berlin. I mean, they're €49, or is it €39? Either way, ridiculously affordable, unlimited travel pass that they now offer is just absolutely spectacular. To be able to have a ticket that you can simply use across these different forms of transport and not worry about things like peak and off peak, not worry if you've got an advance ticket, not worry if I need to use the bus, the tram, the train, the metro, whatever particular method of transport it might be. Similarly, I was in Vienna a couple of weeks ago for the Interiors Innovation Conference from Red Cabin, and learned that in Vienna, they have, in Austria, they have a climate ticket, I believe it's pronounced, and that's €1,000 a year. And again, it's unlimited travel for the entire year. So these kind of opportunities, the connectivity isn't just about the actual system itself. It's also about the actual ticketing and financial accessibility to that system. So I think those examples that we're seeing from Europe, you know, we could definitely learn a lot in terms of making sure that when you've actually built a service that's accessible, making sure that it is literally accessible in a financial and ticketing sense to people.
So you're talking with all these agencies and operators, and you're exchanging ideas and stealing the ones that are the best. And what can you point to anything in North America that you've learned that has shaped your vision?
I learned not to stand in the foyer when I'm traveling with Amtrak and I want to disembark the train. That really took me by surprise. So I had absolutely no idea that on some of your older services, the seats, the steps have to be flipped out of the floor in the vestibule and put down to the platform edge, which really, really took me by surprise. So I learned that, which definitely wouldn't work, I can tell you now, on a peak time service into London Euston. If you tried to stop Londoners or you tried to stop travellers from standing in the train vestibule, it definitely wouldn't go well. So that was a really interesting learning. And I think from my side, I'd love to actually see more of North America's railways. So I've travelled a bit, particularly around kind of Washington, D.C. area. And like I said, on those specific Amtrak services. And I think it would be really interesting to see more about the long distance, which obviously isn't such a problem for us. Our long distances compared to your long distances are leagues apart in terms of the actual distance covered. But I think there could be really interesting lessons to learn about how you maintain a service that's traveling over distances and in landscapes that in some cases are so inhospitable and harsh compared to what we have in the UK and in Europe.
I've got a question. If you went back to your old role at KTN, there's lots of interesting bits and pieces being done across UK rail. So like the stations thing at Temple Meads is fascinating to us because we care about stations, and they're doing it in a station that it's probably quite hard to do innovation stuff in because it's old, it's historic, it's not actually that big. You've got LNER doing cool things with their digital stuff. You've got Southwest Rail playing around with things on the rolling stock. How does it all work together with the different train franchises in terms of sharing, borrowing, stealing, creating?
So that's one of the challenges when we look to the future, is ultimately the goal of Great British Railways is to bring all these ideas and expertise together into a single comprehensive source. So that's what we're pushing for, you know, as we move into the future. In terms of the actual operators and how it works now, you know, operators all talk to each other. The relationships are all very positive and making sure that we're sharing learning, both in terms of things that have gone right and things that have gone wrong. I think one of the things we've got to learn as an industry is to be more open about failures, because learning from failures is just as valuable as learning from something that's gone incredibly well. So we are becoming more open as time goes by about actually sharing those. But that kind of cross TOC or cross train operating company boundary remains a challenge. So making sure that if you've got a piece of software or a digital ticket or whatever it happens to be that applies to one operator, we need to ensure that there's that interoperability between operators too, so that passengers don't end up having to have six different apps for six different journeys that they might end up needing to make. So there's work still to be done, but what I would say is very positively, the industry wants to do it. The appetite is there for better connected working together. And as I said, as we move toward Great British Railways, it's a goal that's in the back of everyone's mind and in the forefront as well.
In terms of like one of the challenges for this, is a lot of it that things aren't necessarily in the same standard. So while the trains all run on the same gauge, but like different companies will have each train offering company has its own app, or the experience in one, like a Network Rail operated station, might be different to the experience in a TransPennine Express operated station. I don't know how much is like, I'm assuming loads and loads of data exists for railways or across the system, but it's not necessarily kept in the same formats or the same levels of what's compatible with another thing. Like a lovely example I saw of this was a Eurostar was running late, and someone who was on that Eurostar had a connection to a Lumo train. And Lumo's kind of, they're not all that frequent, they're sort of low cost. But the train manager from the Eurostar tweeted, hey, Lumo, I have people, I'm running late, these guys are going to miss their thing, can you sort them out? And Lumo went, great, we've let the train managers know for our next departing services. And it was all a hacky version of doing the right thing. But it makes me wonder of like, how does the standards come together to do things that are better ultimately for the employees who have to deal with the passenger as well as the passengers who are trying to have a great experience.
And that is a really interesting one. So for the Eurostar specifically, the train manager can mark your ticket to notify the services that you may be traveling onward in the UK, that if the Eurostar was delayed, that you will be able to use the next service. But you do need to talk, obviously, to the train manager, the conductor, the guard, whatever you want to call them, to actually access that. So there are systems that are in place. And to be honest, I love the kind of social media example. But I grant you, it's definitely not the best way of doing things. It just is our way of doing things. In terms of the data you mentioned, you know, this is a constant issue in Rail, as we do have a lot of data, but quite a bit of it is inaccessible, or it's not in consistent formats, or it's not very easily understandable. So one of the big pieces of work that's happening at the moment is the Rail Data Marketplace project, which again came out of the William Shapps white paper. And the idea behind that is open rail data in consistent formats that can be accessed by anyone. So bringing together of data, all of this again is something that the industry's identified and that we are working towards. But obviously it's not something that we can kind of fix overnight, but it definitely is a priority as we move forward. And it definitely is the future.
It's funny, when Ian was asking this question, the Rail Data Marketplace was exactly where I was going to go next. It's in its infancy now, so it may be of limited value now. How do they, and I apologize if this is not up your alley, but how do we get some recognition, get some exposure to this, so that more people will use it and more data will be available? And I understand it can even lead to connectivity for real-time data as well, not just an exchange of after the fact reporting.
The potential really is endless for a project like that. And obviously they've got an amazing team at the RDM working on this in the project. So firstly, a lot of it is about word of mouth. So across the industry, we should be talking to each other about this. Secondly, it's about events. And I often say to people, you know, Rail really does run on events. Rail really does run on personal relationships and talking to each other at those events. And the Rail Data Marketplace team, again, they go to a lot of different events that are hosted, you know, across the country and on the continent to actually say, hey, we're doing this project. Can you get involved? You know, help us by adding your data, help us by making an account. So the one thing I would say is, even regardless of what stage or what area of rail you might be working in, you know, especially at an operator level, getting involved in that now is only going to be more and more helpful as we go into the future. So I think it really is, a lot of this is, it's the industry's responsibility to talk about it, because it will ultimately benefit the industry. So it's kind of a, why wouldn't we be promoting this program?
I think it'll make a huge difference. And I think it'll be a great way to the 1+1=3 innovation that will come out of this by sharing this data amongst different providers will make a huge difference. So we're running out of time. I just want to ask you, what do you think is the most pressing issue that we need to resolve today? The pet peeve of yours, the one nagging issue that you think needs addressing in short order?
Certainty for the industry. So since William Shapps' report, since COVID, since this major shakeup of our sector, we need greater certainty about what the future will look like. And obviously I know Great British Railways was referenced in the King's Speech about the draft paper, and that's good. But we're at a stage now as an industry where we've seen what's happening in, you know, different manufacturers with job losses. We've seen what's happening with the supply chain around the uncertainty of future projects. We need certainty more than anything else at this moment in time around that program of rail development. And that includes rolling stock, and that includes physical development of lines and upgrade programs and everything else, to make sure that we can actually give that level of assurance to the supply chain at every level. So SMEs that are two people, and startups that have begun in the last, you know, month or so, all the way through to the OEMs and the tier ones of the world. So I would definitely say, wave my magic wand, certainty is what I would create.
And so ironic, you read my mind again. On the paper, it says waving your magic wand. So
it's an apt phrase, because I think to create certainty overnight would be a bit of a magic wand trick. But it's something that, as a process, you know, making sure that we're engaging with and making sure that we're pushing for is really important.
Well, this has been fantastic. Really appreciate your time. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Commute podcast from Boldin Networks. Follow or subscribe on the platform of your choice to stay connected and keep up to date with the latest innovations at boldin.com.